Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring George Daniel, and he'll be answering your most important questions on dynamic nymphing. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask George a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with George Daniel about dynamic nymphing. Our approach is simple. Education. Fly Fusion is unique when it comes to fly fishing magazines. It is one of only a few magazines in North America that focuses on instruction and education. In Fly Fusion, we've covered subjects like short and line nymphing, tactics for tough days, stillwater fly patterns, dry fly fishing for fussy trout, and a host of other interesting and educational topics. Visit our website today at www.flyfusionmag.com. That's www.flyfusionmag.com. And start your subscription to Fly Fusion today so that you can learn all you need to know about fly fishing. Before we introduce George, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. On our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under George's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of George's latest book, Dynamic Nymphing, courtesy of Stackpole Books. And to find out more about Stackpole Books and the offerings they have, go to www.stackpolebooks.com. That's www.stackpolebooks.com. And here's how you can win George's book. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show, and the question is going to be about something we talked about during the show. You must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and hopefully you'll win George's book. Okay. Tonight, our guest is George Daniel. George began fly fishing at age 6 while growing up in Potter County, Pennsylvania, and credits Joe Humphreys for the bulk of his knowledge along with many national and international fly fishing professionals. George has been seen on ESPN and OLN while competing in the Great Outdoor Games and the Fly Fishing Masters. George's passion is in fly fishing education and conducts lectures, seminars throughout the country. He logs over 200 days a year on trout waters near and far. George's first book with Stackpole Books, Dynamic Nymphing, is on sale now. George will have articles published by Fly Fisherman and Fly Tire in 2012, so look for those articles in those magazines. George currently resides in Lamar, Pennsylvania, with his wife and their two children, along with their two golden retrievers that answer to the names of Helos and Madison. He's a pro staffer for a number of fly fishing companies, including Sims, Scott Fly Rod, Scientific Angler, Smith Optics, Lamps and Reels, Loon, Regal Vices, and also George is an Umpqua Flies contract fly designer. Well, George, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thank you, Roger, for having me tonight.
That's how we got off to a rough start here, but it looks like we got a bunch of people online anxious to hear what you got to say. And congratulations on getting that book published. I know you've been working hard on that, and it's quite the accomplishment. I'm looking at a copy right here right now. So great job on that.
Thanks. I had a great support staff and a great editor with Jay Nichols and a number of friends and family members who helped me along the process. So it was a tough journey, but we finally got it done.
Well, what a great thing to have Joe Humphreys do the introduction on your fly there of the book. cover.
It was great to have your lifelong idol. Now that you spent all the years working under him, just idolize him, and then finally have him actually write the foreword to your own book. That was probably one of the best moments of the process.
Yeah. And we did an interview with Joe Humphreys a while back, and it was a great interview, great opportunity to spend some time with him. What a classic icon of the industry, and what a knowledgeable man when it comes to fly fishing, that's for sure. So
yeah,
you had a great mentor. Yeah. Well, let's dive in here. First, we've been basing the interview off your book and trying to get down to a lot of the nymphing techniques and so forth. And Bob in San Francisco couldn't start it off better, asking, what is the definition of dynamic nymphing? What are we talking about here?
Sure. When you look at the word dynamic in the dictionary, one of the things you'll notice is the definition I like is actively searching or seeking. And by dynamic nymphing, I mean that the most productive anglers, the most successful anglers, are ones that are not one-trick ponies that just say, well, I just Euro nymph, or I just use dry dropper, or I just use indicator nymphing. The most successful fly fishers in general are ones that actively search for the best technique for the given water that they fish. So that means that they have a wide range of tools readily available in their fly fishing arsenal and are ready to apply those techniques on any given circumstance or situation when the right conditions present themselves.
So, over the past few years, especially since the international competition started to take place in Europe and so forth, the Euro nymphing techniques have become, a hot topic and continue to be. So what I hear you saying is, hey, we just learned a few more tactics and techniques from the Europeans to add to our arsenal, but they aren't here to replace a lot of the things we were already using, right?
Oh, that's exactly right, Roger. I mean, there are, a lot of the European nymphing techniques that we read about are essentially tight line techniques, that is, not using any sort of indicator or suspension tool to hold or maintain the flies at a fixed depth. Tight line techniques meaning that you are in control of the fly, that you basically maintain the tension between the rod tip and nymph. There are times in river systems, you look at places like the Bighorn, or if you go up to the Bow River, or any stream or conditions where sometimes you have long, slow-moving glides, places where, there are no definitive sections of water where the fish aren't stacked, meaning that like in pocket water or in riffled water where you basically can tell, you can read the water so clearly that you can basically stand up on top of the fish and just pinpoint your cast. There are sections like on the Bighorn where it's just low and just flat and clear, not very definitive water types. So what you need, in my opinion, are sometimes indicators, or what I like to call suspension tools, basically allowing you to make long cast upstream, make amends. A tool like a suspension tool that allows you to make a longer drift and allows you to cover more water with one drift, and the more water you cover, the more likely, or the more, the greater the likelihood that you're going to cover fish. And so what I'm saying is exactly that, is, as much as I love the European nymphing techniques, and as much as I use them back home and throughout the globe and even throughout the West, there are still a time and a place where I may use a dry dropper technique, or I will go to a suspension technique. So, I just don't want to use one technique. I really will do whatever it takes besides using dynamite to catch fish.
That's not, that doesn't fall within the rules of international competition, does it?
No, it doesn't.
we got a lot of questions about equipment and rigging and so forth. So let's start there, and then later on we'll dig into more in depth on some of these techniques you talk about and see if we can give some of our listeners some tips and help along those lines. Martin Coleman in Lawrence, Kansas wrote in, and he said, why have fly fishers gone to longer rods for nymphing than the now traditional 8, 6, and 9-foot? Is that a tendency with the European nymphing techniques as well?
You know, it's something that I think that the European nymphing techniques began to popularize, but even back home in State College where I work for the TCO Fly Shop, you know, there's European nymphing is starting to catch on, but still a lot of anglers don't use those techniques back home. But still, because of the awareness of these some of these techniques and the basically the pushing of long rods, you know, using longer rods, there are a lot of guys now who still don't euro nymph. And some guys, like my good friend and manager, Paul Weimer, who likes to dry fly fish, you know, and one of his favorite waters is on the Delaware River. He loves using 10-foot rods, and not just for nymphing, but for dry fly fishing. And I think the main reason why anglers are going towards these longer rods is just not because of nymphing, but because it is just a tool. Basically, it's a lever that allows you to hold more line and leader off the water, just providing you better line and leader control. I think that's the big kicker. It just allows you to hold more line leader off the water. And the problem is everyone knows any, even an extra foot of fly line or even leader on the water creates excessive drag. And one of the things I really dislike is actually having to make mends or manage line on the water. I try to keep as much line and leader off the water as possible. That means less slack and more in control I am with the drift, whether I'm nymphing or dry fly fishing. So for those reasons alone, I think longer rods have come into play. Also, the technology. If you look at some of the rods I started playing with 6-7 years ago, rods that were, you know, rated for 10-foot 5, 10-foot 6 weights, because of technology or this, there wasn't that much emphasis on good rod design and those lengths and line weights back in the day, you would find rods with exceptionally heavy tips or just completely off balance, rods that would really almost put wear and tear on your hand just holding them. Today now, there are, with the technology and with so much emphasis in these longer rods, all rod manufacturers these days are coming up with exceptional rod designs, even in the $200, $250 range, rated for 10-foot 4 weights, 10-foot 3 weights, to 10-foot 5 weights, but longer rods that have good action, but more importantly, are balanced and are not tip-heavy and feel comfortable in your hand over a long period of time.
Now, what do you so it sounds like it's a matter of choice for the fly fisher as to where they feel comfortable, and would you generally recommend 9-10 foot rod for most nymphing situations for people?
Oh, absolutely. You know, absolutely. Most of the time, even back home on the streams that I fish most often in central Pennsylvania, I'm talking about some of the spring creeks and small limestone streams in comparison to some of the western waters. But we're talking about streams that are maybe 15 all the way up to maybe 75, 80 feet in length. But often I'm using rods 10 foot. Most of the time my mainstay rod right now is a 10-foot 5 weight that I use back home. Anytime I have, you know, unless I'm in a situation where I have heavy over, you know, lots of overcover, tree branches, I mean, literally like a rhododendron tunnel over my head, if I have a clear opening, as long as there's vegetation on the bank, but I have a clear opening directly overhead where I can move my rod tip without constantly running into tree branches, I'm almost always using at least a 9.5 or a 10-foot rod.
Okay. Julie in Athens, Georgia asks about the Tenkara rods and whether you find those useful for nymphing and can they be used for any of the European nymphing techniques?
You know, that's kind of funny. I just kind of really, you know, I've been doing some of the shows for the fly fishing show circuit, and I know one of the presenters was a Tenkara gentleman who's been going around showing the techniques, and I just went on to YouTube and started looking up Tenkara. And sure enough, there's check nymphing with 10-carat rods, I think, on the Madison River. By all means, absolutely, it's definitely a tool. I mean, especially when you think about the long rods, about being able to hold line leader off the water, those 10-carat rods exceed, if I remember correctly, 11 foot and go upward maybe another foot or so. But it can definitely be used as a tool for check nymphing. The problem is, my one problem is if you're fishing big water and you land into, you know, if you hook into a big fish without any type of drag system and basically keep maintaining a fixed line between the rod tip and the nymph, if you hook into a big fish in a heavy riff, you may have some difficulties landing the fish. But other than that, it is definitely applicable check nymphing in combination with tankara rods on some conditions, it could definitely be used.
Okay, okay. We have a few questions here on moving on now to lines and leaders. And Fred in Fresno, California asks, George, what size tippet do you prefer on your tag ends, on your Czech nymphs, and on your Polish leaders? And maybe you take this opportunity to kind of explain, starting out with the European nymphing techniques, the differences in how you rig up as far as, your terminal tackle on the different styles.
Sure. First, I'm not sure if this is the Fred that I know from Fresno. We used to have qualifiers in Fresno, California, and I remember a Fred from Fresno that actually we called him Fast Freddy because he would actually drive us from the venues from the hotel. But I'm hoping it's the same Freddy. So if it is, hi, Fred, and thanks for your question. Two, when you're talking about leader setups, one of the things I really don't like to do anymore is really make extreme distinctions between whether I'm French nymphing or if I'm Czech nymphing or Spanish nymphing, because within, I would say, probably the last couple of years when I was over there, overseas, competing and traveling in throughout parts of Europe, when you talk to those guys, a lot of the guys overseas, they don't say, well, I'm Spanish nymphing or I'm French nymphing. They would just say I'm tight line nymphing or a lot of times short line nymphing and long line nymphing based on the length that they're making the presentation. So one of the things that we ended up finding out with a lot of these competitors is that they ended up doing like a hybrid leader, one leader that could basically work in just about all conditions. So the leader that I'm going to go over here with you is the leader that I like to use in the wide range of conditions. I feel like I can use it up close, and I can also use it for longer distances. And this leader goes like this. I start off with a 9-foot OX leader. It's a stand. You can use any standard knotless leader, 9-foot OX leader, knotless. The reason is because so often with longer leaders, part of the leader at some point during the drift is going to be within your guides. So what you want to make sure happens is if you have a seamless transition, you don't want to have knots. Even if you super glue or coat a hand-tied leader, it's still going to knock and ding within those guides. So one of the things I like to do, and most of the guys on the U.S. fly fishing team and overseas, they use a long knotless leader as your base, just so it can smooth up and down through the guides without too much friction. So we're starting with a 9-foot OX leader. Then I like to have a sider, basically a colored section of monofilament built in the middle part of my leader. This will act as my strike indicator, just basically an addition of the leader. It maintains the taper of the leader, but it's colored, and it just allows me to detect any additional movement when my flies stop during a drift. So what I'll do is use a blood knot, and I'll tie in about 20 inches of colored monofilament. Lately, I've been using a product called Yon Saman, bicolor indicator. It's a two-tone color indicator where you have a section of bright orange and a section of bright red all within a given piece. And I use about 20 inches, usually about 10 inches of the bright color and about 10 inches of the light color. So I have my 9-foot OX leader. I have my 20-inch section of cider material. And then off of that, I tie in a tiny steel micro tippet ring, just a tiny little ring that I actually build into the end of my cider material. What this ring does, it allows you to create a connector from your main line near your leader to your tippet. So basically you have this little tiny ring hanging off the base of your leader. So when you attach your tippet to the actual tippet ring, you always attach it directly to the ring, meaning that you attach it to the ring, you never cut back on the actual leader. So this little tippet ring will actually create an everlasting leader for you. So I have my 9-foot OX, my 20-inch section of cider material, my tippet ring, and then off of that, I usually have my tippet material, and it's usually level materials if I'm nymph fishing, and most often that is straight 4X or 5X fluorocarbon material tied to either one or two flies based on the depth and speed of the water. The reason why I like fluorocarbon is I'm not exactly sold on the fact that it's completely invisible. Just doing a lot of snorkeling, doing some underwater observations, it's definitely less visible, but I don't want to say it's invisible. But the things I am sold on fluorocarbon are this. One, it has far better knot strength. I think about 30% stronger knot strength once it's wet as compared to nylon. And then two, and just as important, it has far greater resistance to abrasion. And this is important, especially if you're spending all this time and money tying or buying tungsten beads, or if in some cases actually buying $2 and $3 tungsten flies. The resistance to abrasion actually will last a lot longer. You'll get far fewer break-offs, and you'll save a lot more money in the long run.
So now that's you're going to use that for the different techniques, and then you're just going to you're going to shorten up your tippet based upon whether you're going long or short line?
Yeah, my tippet is almost always between 3 and 5 foot. And most of the time, on average, I'm just going to say 5 foot. And most of the time, I maintain that 5 foot to my, to my flies, meaning that if I'm fishing shallower water, my cider material is simply going to be held higher out of the water. If I'm fishing water that's 4.5, 5 foot deep, most of my cider material is going to be right on the water, if that makes sense. So I will adjust the height of the cider material off the surface of the water based on the depth of the water. Again, in fishing shallower water, my cider material is going to be held off higher off the water because I'm fishing shallower water. If I'm fishing in deeper water, my cider material is going to be a lot closer to the surface and sometimes actually within the surface current just because my flies are down deep in the water.
So you're making adjustments in your rod.
Correct.
As far as, you know, how high or off the water it is to adjust the depth of your line, not changing
correct.
The length of your leader. Okay, gotcha.
Correct. And the important thing here, too, is in order to maintain line leader control and really, in my opinion, to have that good connection, you need to have a lower rod hand and a steep rod tip angle. That dynamic, having a low rod hand and a steeper rod tip angle, creates a greater angle and therefore I think creates a tighter connection between you and your nymph. So as you are adjusting the height of the cider or the height of the rod tip, you don't lower your rod tip. What you will lower your rod tip, but you don't push your rod tip down towards the water. Instead, what I will do in deeper water, I will actually lower my rod hand, still lowering the rod tip, but still maintaining that steep angle. So it'll get in situations where if I'm fishing deep, deep water, and I need my cider close to the water, I'll get to the point where my rod hand will be literally almost at the surface, at the level of the surface, but still maintaining a steeper angle with my rod tip angled upward slightly, but allowing that cider material to become closer to the surface. But the important part is just maintain a steeper rod tip angle to keep that tight connection between rod tip and nymph.
So basically, you've got, I guess an average person would have about a 7 foot range then by just moving your rod handle, rod hand up and down, right?
Approximately, yes. Yep, exactly.
Up over your head, you could be maybe seven, 8 feet, depending on how tall you are, and all the way down to 0 feet on the water.
Correct.
So you put that much movement there. Okay, good. Makes sense. We need to take a quick break, George, but we'll be right back and want to hear more. I'm already learning all kinds of things from you. So hang tight. We'll be right back.
Okay.
Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging onto their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with George Daniel about dynamic nymphing. If you'd like to ask George a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, George, at this point in the show, I always ask my guests, you know, what's going on in their fly fishing world, and obviously your book has probably taken up a lot of your time in the past year or two, but what's going on with you?
No, that's been taking up a large part of my life, the book, the completion of the book, and then, you know, when they say the book is done, the work is not really done because the promotion – and the traveling and the tours actually begin. So I've been very busy on the road circuit, doing a lot of shows for the fly fishing show, and then probably not actually having a day off until mid-June, going to just about every fly fishing show I can find in the Midwest, and I'll be going to Pleasanton. I'll be at Bob Marriott's later this year, and just the Midwest Fly Fishing Expo, and just a countless number of other small organizations and fly fishing organizations. I'll be working all the way to about mid-June. So that's been keeping me busy. And then the other part of my life is my family. I have a 3- and 1-year-old boy, a girl and boy, along with a beautiful wife. That's been keeping a lot of my attention. And then just recently we bought a foreclosed house, an old farmhouse, on one of my favorite trout streams in Pennsylvania. So we're actually in the last 7 months in the process of restoring this old farmhouse back to its hopefully livable conditions, and we'll be in this house in about 4 weeks, hopefully. For the last 7 months, my family and I have been living out of a little tiny suitcase in a small apartment, and just it's amazing what you can do or how much you can actually live without with bare essentials. So we're actually looking forward to moving into this new house and actually moving on with normal day life.
Yeah, fantastic. Sounds like an exciting time for your family. Yeah,
it
That's
is.
Great. Yeah, and do you have a website or?
I personally don't have a website. People can follow me on Facebook. If you look up George Daniel on Facebook, it has a picture of some ugly fly fishing with two cute young kids beside them. That is my picture with my two kids. So that's my Facebook handle. And then this fly shop that I work for and where you can actually follow me and contact me is at www.tco. That stands for Topahawken Creek Outfitters, tcoflyfishing.com.
Okay, tcoflyfishing.com. Terrific, terrific. Well, I'm sure everybody will look forward to seeing you on the show circuit. And so, folks, you might try to look George up there. I know he does a lot of speaking engagements and stuff, so try to find him. I'm looking here, and actually I have this question later in the agenda, but talking about this curlicue leader, and you mentioned it a minute ago too. Can you tell us about that and what it is and what purpose it has and what you do with it?
Sure. What I have come up with, and again, this is, you ask maybe 5 or 6 of the anglers the same question, you get 5 or 6 different answers. But for me, when it comes to the curlicue, I use the curlicue in extreme conditions. And basically what the curlicue is this. Regular cider material, that is that colored monofilament that we're talking about, that straight colored monofilament that we're talking about using as just a standard indicator in our leader. What the French did a number of years ago, and they actually got this off the English coarse fishermen from way back. So this is actually something that's been practiced for a very, very long time. Originally started by the English coarse fishermen, if I remember correctly. The French adapted to their fly fishing techniques maybe within the last 20 years or whatever. But essentially what they're doing is this. They're taking straight colored monofilament, and they're wrapping it around a round object, whether that's a small wooden dowel or a pencil or a straw, but essentially securing both ends, securing one end, wrapping the colored monofilament around this cylinder, maybe 8, 10, 15 wraps. It's all personal preference, securing the other end. What they'll do then is they'll boil it. And what the boiling does, it conforms it to the actual object. So it basically creates it creates curves in your leader. And then what they do after that, after they boil it for about 12 to 13 minutes, is that they'll actually freeze it. And what the freezing does, what they claim it does, it maintains memory. So once you boil it and freeze it, it's the only time I do any type of cooking at home, but once you're done doing this little batch, you can actually take it out of the freezer and pull it off this wooden dowel. And what you get is essentially this slinky-like looking version of color monofilament. It comes off in a slinky formula. And what I use it for is used as a suspension tool. That is like an indicator, something that can hold a lightly weighted nymph. I'll grease this thing. And you'll grease this, and you'll treat it like a dry dropper or like an actual suspension tool, like an indicator. You'll cast it out. And what you're looking for is for that curlicue. That curlicue, because it, in that slinky form, sits high off the water. And I just wrote an article for fly fishermen called Fishing Skinny Water. And what you're looking for is for that curlicue, once it's laying out of the water, to move or hesitate. And that's going to tell you when and when not a fish is going to eat, or when the fly actually is inhaled or is stopped by a piece of vegetation or rock. The reason why you use a curlicue over a straight piece of monofilament, because for a long time people just said, well, all you need to do is just grease colored monofilament, or just you grease a section of your leader and you can look at it. That's fine within maybe 20, 25 feet, because when you're standing while you're looking down, you can see that leader. The problem becomes from a visibility standpoint is when you actually have to make those few occasions, longer casts. Maybe I'm talking casts 60, 70 feet away. God forbid that ever has to happen, but it does have to happen on a few occasions. When you make a long cast like that, at that distance, the plane, that is the angle from your eye to your actual indicator, is less. And that thing becomes almost submerged in the water. You can't see it as well. So what you need at that distance is an indicator tool that sits higher out of the water that allows you to see those takes or be able to notice those takes from a longer distance. And that's where that curlicue, which is just a small little indicator that can only suspend a lightly amount of weight. That is a fly that maybe has a little bead head on it or maybe just a few lead wraps of wire, but not much weight. But it's just something that you can cast, and the indicator is sensitive enough to detect lightly weighted flies fished maybe a few inches out underneath the surface from a longer distance. Hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah, now, how does that – so you emphasized lightweight flies, so I'm taking it if you have a tandem rig or something, this is going to be – you're going to straighten that out anyway, and it's not going to do –
you're going to straighten it out or it's going to sink, because when you think about it, you have the curlicue, even when it once it's greased, only has so much surface area and can only suspend so much weight. So if you're fishing tungsten flies quite often or even a little bit of split shot often, if you see that curlicue actually getting pulled under or straightened, that's telling you that that rig is way too heavy for the curlicue. Mm-hmm. So usually when I'm talking about fishing lightly weighted nymphs, I'm talking about fishing flies, smaller flies, maybe sizes 14 and smaller, but usually using beadhead flies, not tungsten, but just regular brass bead flies with maybe like 3/32 brass bead on it with no additional weight. So we're talking about fishing very lightly weighted flies. This is a tool used for fishing lightly weighted flies, so when you're fishing long flats or very skinny water, you don't need much depth. Or on some situations, it's a great tool for fishing sunken flies just a few inches underneath the surface. One of my favorite times to use it, this curlicue, is during the trico hatch back home in central Pennsylvania or even like on the Bighorn, where you have sunken trico spinners. So you're just fishing a small little glass bead trico spinner, maybe an inch underneath the surface. And this suspension tool has enough buoyancy to suspend that lightly weighted fly, but still has enough tension when the fish does take, it's going to react to any movement of the fly moving in a different direction other than the current.
Does this curlicue affect your casting ability? Does it mess with that at all?
Yeah, that's a good point. What you need to remember is usually I like to use anywhere between 8 to 12 wraps. And that's kind of ideal. It allows you to create a tool that has just enough buoyancy to suspend lightly weighted flies. But once you start making coils, once you start wrapping, 15, 16, I've seen some people use, 30 inches of curlicues, and essentially that's like 40 wraps. And you're talking about a pile of wraps, and the longer the curlicue, the more air resistance it is, and therefore becomes a nuisance when you're actually casting, especially in windier conditions. So ideally, I try to keep my curlicues between 8 to 12 wraps. That's perfect, just enough to create the buoyancy I need to suspend lightly weighted flies, but still is not a hindrance to my cast.
I just wanted to ask you about these the tippet rings. I have not used those personally. Are those very lightweight? Is that adding additional weight to your nymphing rig? Or?
No, they're very lightweight. Just consider it almost like an eye of a 16 dry fly. That's all it is. Just a micro ring. It doesn't hinge your cast. It won't sink. So it's basically just a a light loop, a leader loop, or a monofilament loop off your butt section of your leader. But it does not really affect your cast, does not do anything other than just creates, I guess, simplicity in your life and allows you, especially those who are frugal and like to save a few dollars, especially in this economy, it saves a lot of wear and tear in your leader.
I just got a question on the internet from Steve in Monument, Colorado. He says, do you tie all the flies onto the micro ring or trail them behind each other? Because he's talking about, you know, multi-fly rigs.
Correct. You can use that. That's a very good question. Most of the time I just use the tippet ring solely as a tool to connect my leader to my tippet. The problem happens is you can absolutely use those micro rings to tie off of droppers. The problem is, as it happens with the best of us, at some point in time you're going to wrap that rig around the tree or you're going to lose that rig. Those micro rings are such a bear to actually get onto your systems. I usually do it on my rigging in the house. So if you're on the stream, especially in the cold day or if you're in a windy condition and your hands are cold and numb, it is almost impossible, even for me, to get those micro rings tied on to my droppers. So for that matter, I just use it solely as a means to connect my leader to my tippet.
So for us guys that are over 50, can we possibly tie those things on?
Yeah,
sounds like I can imagine, because you got nothing to hold on to, right?
With the way the dispensers are, Angler's Image and some other manufacturers now, they actually have like a safety pin. They're actually loaded onto a safety pin where you can actually tie your tippet onto it, do your clinch knot or whatever tippet knot you like to do to your tipper ring, and then once you accomplish the knot, you can actually slide it off the dispenser. So that makes life so much easier.
Yeah.
But still becomes difficult in cold water when your hands decide they don't want to cooperate with you.
Yeah. Now, we had quite a few questions that I'm not asking here that we're answering from folks about this setup. We're talking about tandem rigs here, two nymph systems. Steve Bourne, who's been on our show as a guest as well in Madison, Wisconsin, he asks, do you normally favor two nymph systems or three, and when do you prefer just a single nymph rig?
Okay, that's another great question. Thanks for the question, Steve. Most of the time I am fishing two flies, almost always fishing two flies. I think two flies balance each other out. I think during the drift, I think it's nice to have one fly sometimes act as the attractor. As you know, sometimes, you know, they say trout are super reactive. That's the case. But sometimes they're to the point where it takes one flashy fly maybe on the dropper to get the attention. They let that one go, and then next thing you know, a split second later, another fly drifts past its mouth and gets its attention. So for those reasons, I like fishing two flies. Plus, it allows me to fish two different flies most often and gives me two different options, and often I can find what fish are actually feeding on. As an example, like in a hatch, if I'm fishing the beginning of a hatch, say, for example, on the sulfurs back home in central Pennsylvania, I may begin the morning just with two sulfur nymphs, dredging them right along the bottom. But as the hatch progresses, those nymphs become active. You'll find that fish are not only just feeding on the nymphs crawl on the bottom, but also nymphs that are beginning to emerge towards the surface. So in those situations where you have fish feeding on both levels, I like to have a fly in the point and maybe a lighter weight dropper on the top, just because you're covering two levels. The time when I switch solely to fishing one fly usually has to do with the type of water that I'm fishing, meaning that the water quality. Have you ever? One of the things you need to think about is what's going on underneath the surface, micro drag. Think about the number of currents within a given area, especially in pocket water. If you really study and look at pocket water, you'll see, coming off a boulder, you'll see currents pulling. But if you look really closely, often you'll see two or three currents, all within maybe a foot length of one another, meaning that if I fish two flies maybe a foot and a half, 2 foot apart, there's a good chance that each one of those nymphs are going to land in a different speed current, meaning that they're going at some point pull against one another, creating tension and not allowing my flies to drop as quickly. So when I'm fishing pocket water, areas where there is a high concentration of a number of currents in a small area, I actually will actually go to fishing just a single nymph, meaning that I will just focus my weight, center my weight in the one area to reduce drag or having the likelihood of another fly getting picked up by a different current and actually creating additional drag on my rig. So in water where there's maybe not much variance, where there's pretty even flow, you can fish two or three flies. But when you have areas where there's a good area chance that your flies are going to land in different speed currents, I like to just switch to a single weight fly or just use split shot, focus my split shot in the one area, just so it anchors in that one area.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. And that kind of leads me to this question from Sprout Dubois in Utah. And he asks, what is the best way to learn how your rig is drifting underwater while you are fishing, which is kind of what you were just talking about. Is it more an anticipatory kind of approach, in other words, like you're saying, when you've got the multiple currents? Or
you can look at it in a couple different ways. If we're going to just talk about tight line nymphing right now, that is the time where we're actually using cider material into our rig. One of the things that I like to look at is, one, is that looking at the angle of my cider, meaning that I want my cider angled upstream. Because ideally, in a perfect world, the rod tip, the angler maintains that rod tip downstream of the nymph. That maintains a slight degree of tension on the flies, allowing you to detect any subtle take. So one of the things I like to do, knowing that my flies are drifting properly, the first thing I'm looking for is for my cider to actually be angled slightly upstream. That means that my rod tip is downstream of my nymph, and I have some sort of, I believe, control or tension with that nymph. If I see my cider angled away from me, or actually angled downstream of the rod tip, that's telling me that my flies are downstream of the rod tip and most likely are creating slack, and I'm not in control of my drift. So I'm looking at that first. I'm looking at the angle of my cider. Where's my cider in relation to my flies? And most often I want my cider angled upstream. Two is, you have to think about hydraulics. What you see on the surface is not what you always see on the bottom. You have to think about this, about stratified current speeds. There are times, for example, like on Spring Creek back home in central Pennsylvania, it's a relatively shallow water. You have water that is on average maybe about shin deep. The water doesn't really stratify a whole lot. The same current on the surface is normally what you see on the stream bottom. So ideally, in those situations, what I'm looking for, along with my cider angled upstream, is for my cider to be moving about the same speed as the current, because what the current speed on the bottom is the same as it is on top. However, if I'm fishing pocket water, where you have some faster currents coming over on the surface, but you may have some boulders or some areas down underneath that actually create some dead spots, some slower currents, what you have to do is you have to look down the stream bottom and kind of gauge about how fast those currents are actually moving. And in those situations where you have stratified currents, where you have slower currents on the bottom, what you need to look for is, again, looking for that cider to be angled upstream, but also you want the cider moving slightly slower than the current.
Okay. Now, you're talking about tight line nymphing techniques.
Yes.
What about in the case of when you're using suspension systems?
Absolutely. The same principles exist. There are indicators, for example, that actually have tip tops or designs that actually allow you to see angles of the drift. One of my favorite indicators is actually the Fama bobber. I use that more than anything else. The one problem with the indicator is that it's just a small little sphere, and it's basically the same angle on, it's a perfect sphere. So there's no angles on that indicator. So when your flies are angled at a different angle or angled away from your rod tip, you can't really trace where your flies are in relation to your indicator. So one of the things I like to do is I actually like to tie my Fama bobber right above my cider, leaving maybe 5 or 6 inches of cider material below my Thema bobber. So when I cast, I still have a short section of color monofilament between my Thema bobber and my flies. And when my flies are tracking straightly, what I'm looking for with my Thema bobber is for that tipping material to be still angled upstream from my Thema bobber towards my flies. If I start seeing that color monofilament again moving downstream or moving at an angle downstream of my Thema bobber, that's telling me, again, that my flies are downstream of my Thema bobber and there are slack in the system. The other thing is, again, is about the speed. You know, if you're fishing level currents where there's no stratified speeds in the currents, I'm looking for my Thema bobber to move approximately the same speed as the current. If I'm fishing currents which are exceptionally fast on the current surface but slow on the bottom, I'm going to be looking for my indicator to move slightly slower than the currents. If that is the case, that means that my flies are bit into that slower current and actually pulling back on my indicator, now allowing my indicator to move faster than the currents.
Okay. We need to take a quick break, but when we come back, let's talk about flies. Got a bunch of questions about flies.
Sure.
Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services they offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services, and they have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with George Daniel about dynamic nymphing. If you'd like to ask George a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. And use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, George, we got a few questions here on flies. Chuck in Santa Rosa, California asks, how important is exact pattern and check nymphing? What is more important, size, shape, color, et cetera, for your flies?
That's a good question. Again, looking at what is the definition of check nymphing or check patterns, you know, you look at check patterns 5-6 years ago, typical check pattern, people would say, well, it's just a caddis larva or a grub pattern, you know, heavily weighted. You look at check patterns today, check pattern is not indicating a particular type of fly, in my opinion. It is emphasizing a weighted fly. Basically, the idea that check patterns are this. They are weighted or sometimes heavily weighted, but also are thin in diameter. Thin profile will allow the flies to drop quickly to the bottom. That's my definition of check patterns. When it comes to what, you know, are the best types of check patterns, in my opinion, going back on my competitive years when I was with the U.S. fly fishing team and coaching the U.S. youth team for 2 years, I had the great privilege of being able to talk and spend a lot of time with some of the top-notch guys. And in 2007, if I remember correctly, we had the U.S. or the the World Fly Fishing Championships for the youth here in central Pennsylvania on my home waters. And the French kid in particular, I forget his name, but he was the individual gold medal winner. And the amazing thing to me is afterwards, all the kids were asking, can we see your fly box? He comes back and he shows everyone his fly box. And when he opens up his fly box, it was, I guess, in so many ways, it was one of the most disappointing things all of us had ever seen, because all it was just a few variations of hares, ears, pheasant tails, and a couple ugly-looking grub patterns. Just very basic, very suggestive patterns, patterns that imitate a wide range of insects, nothing fancy, nothing that you would see in a fly tying book. And to answer your question, the best patterns, in my opinion, are ones that are suggestive, that imitate a wide range of insects. You look at patterns like the Frenchie, which is basically a pheasant tail with a little hot spot right in front of the bead. It could be a hot spot made of thread or a hot spot made of thread or made of dubbing material. But patterns like the hare's ears, pheasant tails, just general suggestive patterns that you can tweak and change it up a little bit, maybe some sizes and some colors, but things that you can use just about any time of the year. Those, in my opinion, are the best patterns. The only time I want to get really imitative is, for example, if you're fishing hatches, like, for example, the green drake hatch or the ice snakey hatch, you're talking about trying to imitate nymphs that have a very unique physical characteristic, very prominent gills, or something very prominent that stands out far more than alone than any other nymph. In those situations, I'll tie a more imitative nymph. But for the most part, I am fishing very simple, suggestive patterns.
Okay. And Mike Nolan, Melbourne, Australia, asks, how do you choose the brightness of a fly or bead color depending on water clarity, on how sunny or cloudy the day is? Do you differentiate there?
Sure. You know, like anything else, trout are just unusual creatures. When you think you have something figured out or you crack the code, they turn around and they just make a fool of you. But generally, in some situations back home, in low clear water conditions, I have gone a lot more to the brass and the black colored beads. Just in high pressure situations where fish are used to seeing lots and lots of fit or pressure, often I will go to a fly with a little less tone, just dulled down a little bit. That's where I switch to the brass and also the black beads. When I'm fishing conditions where it's lots of sun, brightly lit conditions, I prefer to actually fish a silver bead. And I don't know why, but I think silver works really well during brightly lit conditions. And when trout are optimistic and really on the feed, or whenever you're looking for that little extra gaudiness or just a little extra flare in your pattern, that's where I will go to a brightly colored gold bead. There's a number of other options. For example, we were in the Italian Alps just this last year for the World Fly Fishing Championships. We were fishing many of the streams coming off glacial streams in the Alps. And for whatever reason, patterns with a fluorescent pink bead were by far the most productive patterns. It didn't matter really what type of fly you put the bead on, but just as long as it had that fluorescent pink bead in that glacial till water. So there's always exceptions to the rule, but those first things that I mentioned about the brass and the dark for the highly fished waters, along with the silver for the bright conditions, along with the gold for the, you know, gaudy or just trying to get a little extra flare, those are my general rules for using bead color.
Okay. And along the same line, Sally Sheets in Manitou Springs, Colorado asks, so many tires use flashy materials when tying nymphs. Do you think this is effective? If so, under what conditions? Does this fall in line with your bead selection as well?
It does in some situations. Again, I've never been able to completely crack the code. I think the best flies actually have a combination of, you know, dull colors along with flashy materials. Again, going back to the pheasant tail or the Frenchie, you look at a fly like the Frenchie, which is basically a pheasant tail with coque de Lion for the tail, pheasant tail for the body, a little bright orange collar behind a bead. Didn't matter what color the bead, but it's just the right combination of flash versus natural. There are times, like in the southeast, when you're fishing rainbows, like those little small streams in the southeast for wild little rainbow trout. For whatever reason, I like using flashy patterns. A lot of ice-colored dub flies with UV or any type of fly type material with UV qualities I like to use very well. The other times I like to use gaudy colors is actually in the wintertime, like right now back home. In the dead of wintertime where I think fish are a little bit more lethargic, they're just not as active. Sometimes I think they need a little trigger, a little encouragement. So during extremely cold weather conditions or when the fish just have lockjaw, those are the times I actually like to fish the gaudy patterns, flies that I think just give the fly or give the fish a few more enticements to go after.
Okay. David in Dallas, Georgia asked about what flies and multi-fly setups do you find most effective. So I'm going to add on to this, you know, maybe when you're doing a searching kind of approach, how do you usually rig up? What flies do you normally put on?
Sure. If I'm fishing a hatch, for example, if I know the bugs that are hatching prominently, if I know the fish are on those bugs, I will begin matching the hatch, essentially, just looking at and covering the level. So if they're both taken, if all the fish are taken, you know, nymphs deep, you'll fish a rig like that. And as they begin to surface or move, you know, through the layers, I'll fish rigs that allow me to cover multiple levels. and then I'll get to a point where maybe they're just taking a merger underneath the surface. That's where I may go to a curlicue, fishing a lightly weighted fly right underneath the surface. There are times, for example, where you need to fish distance, or if you're fishing like late summer along a grassy bank where you have the likelihood that there's going to be lots of grasshoppers. In conditions like that, that's where you can go to a dry dropper rig, something where you can have a dry fly on the surface and a nymph underneath, just that you're covering both levels, and then you're also covering most of your major food on the surface and then also food opportunities underneath. There are, in my opinion, there are just, you know, so many options about how you develop your rig based on the conditions. Every time out there is a different scenario. Again, it's just about, if you're fishing pocket water where you have lots of currents within a given area, I'm going to fish flies, maybe a single fly or a fly that's relatively close. If I'm fishing big water where I'm trying to search, like on the Muskegon River in Michigan, where you have this exceptionally large expanse of water, and I'm trying to swing flies and really search, try to cover water as much as I can, that's where I'll fish three flies, maybe spaced 3 feet apart, and I'll fish a fly on the dropper, the first dropper, which is exceptionally maybe heavy but also very gaudy-looking pattern to first get the fish's attention, and then I may drop two lightly weighted, more natural-looking bugs on the middle dropper than on the point in the hopes that the fish is going to eat that fly. So hopefully that answers some of your questions, but there are just so many ways to make a rig, and in my opinion, there's really no right way to make a rig.
How do you, George, organize your fly boxes?
Fly boxes for nymphs, I do it all with weight. So I have four fly boxes. I have a box that's condensed to unweighted or exceptionally lightly weighted flies. That is, flies with just brass beads. Then I have a lightly weighted tungsten fly box where normally the flies will range anywhere from like a 14 down to a 20, but normally have tungsten beads the size of 7/64 and smaller. Then I have like a medium rig or medium weight where a lot of my flies are tied on a 1/8 inch tungsten bead along with lead wire. And then I have my heavy flies, which some people refer to as anchors, flies that are going to get heavy and drop the entire rig down to the bottom. Those flies are usually like your larger stonefly patterns, your big worm patterns, larger caddisfly larva patterns, but flies that are tied on like 5/32 of an inch of a tungsten bead along with lead wire. So I have four different systems right there that I use for weighting my fly boxes.
Now, does that mean you tend not to use weight on your tippet or leaders?
That's a good point. You know, and one of the things whether you like, you know, this European nymphing techniques or not, but one of the things, you know, even after I'm done competing, which, you know, I've stepped away completely from the competitive field to focus more on my family and just do things for my own profession, but one of the things that will stick with me forever, as far as I'm concerned, is actually this transition from switching from split shot to weighted flies for a couple of reasons. One is you look at split shot. The problem is when you're nymph fishing, the biggest problem most anglers have is adjusting, and that is constantly taking split shot on and off the leader. When you do that, taking split shot on and off the leader for me is an absolute hassle. It got to a point where you have to have a knife almost ready at any given point to actually try to pry that split shot off the leader. So that's a problem. It just takes so long for me to change split shot on and off the leader. Compared to changing flies, I can switch flies back and forth within 20 to 30 seconds. It's so much quicker for me to change flies. So I can change weights, that is, so much quicker with flies than I can with split shot. Another thing with split shot is that once you crimp it onto the leader, it creates dings in your leaders, therefore creating weak spots. So at some point throughout the day, if you don't change your tippet, all of a sudden you hook a fish, you make a good hook set, and all of a sudden the line goes free, and you look at your fly, your tippet, and you see this perfect incision, just as like someone took a pair of scissors and just sliced down to the tippet. That's often that weak ding where that the split shot actually cut down or pinched onto that leader. So it creates weak spots. The other thing about weighted flies is they create tension, and this is especially important when you're playing fish. Everyone is always, I guarantee at some point, has fished multiple unweighted flies in combination with split shot. You get that little 5-6 inch dink that decides it wants to come to the surface and starts flopping around, and what you end up with is a ball's nest on the end of your leader, and it takes you, 5-10 minutes to completely re-rig. The advantage with weighted flies is that they maintain tension and they don't tangle nearly as much. They will tangle, but not as much. So it really reduces the, I guess, the workload on you in the long run. Fourth is in the water itself. When you use weighted flies, it creates a more direct tension from your rod tip to your nymph. As compared to fishing unweighted flies with split shot, often there's a little bit of slack between your split shot and your nymph. Don't get me wrong. People have used split shot with unweighted flies for a number of years, and it will work and it will continue to work. But I feel that having a weighted fly, it just provides or creates a more direct link. There's just more tension between the rod tip and the nymph, and therefore I think increases the sensitivity the angler has when detecting takes.
Okay. Well, George, we need to take another quick break here, but we'll be right back, and we'll be talking about some tight line and suspension tactics here. So stick with us here, folks, and we'll be back in a moment. Harper Creek Fly Fishing Company is North Carolina's premier backcountry fly fishing guide service. Located in Lenoir, North Carolina, at the base of the Blue Ridge Mountains, we fish some of the most beautiful limestone spring creeks North Carolina has to offer. Plus, our guide has over 15 years of professional experience, and in addition to our backcountry guide services for experienced anglers, we offer intensive full-day instructional trips for the novice angler. So come spend a day with us in fly fishing paradise. For more information on our services, please visit our website located at www.nc-flyfishing.com. That's nc-flyfishing.com. Or call 828-758-2446. That's 828-758-2446. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with George Daniel about dynamic nymphing. If you'd like to ask George a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. Okay, George, let's talk about some techniques here, tight line techniques. You know, we've talked about the Czech, Polish, French, American, that kind of thing. Can you give us a brief rundown on how you see these different techniques when we're talking? I know before you alluded to the fact that we're talking in Europe, they talk short, you know, or long line nymphing. Can you describe the differences between Czech, Polish, French, that kind of thing for us?
Sure. You know, and I'll do the best I can. You know, going over, being over there for 7 years, there's still no exact definition. But ideally is this. You can look at the Czech and Polish, and you can almost classify that as a single technique. There's actually a lot of debate as to who came up with the technique first. In fact, if you put a Pole and a Czech in the same room together and come up with a discussion about who came up with the technique first, there's going to probably be a fist fight. It was kind of funny. Back in 2006, when I was in Portugal on my first World Championship, my dear friend and fellow Pole, because I'm actually Polish myself, but Vladi, a former world champion back in 1989, I believe, in Finland, but he was our assistant coach, helping the U.S. team out there. And there were two guys in my room. We were time flies with Vladi. And Lance Egan and myself were actually time flies with Vladi, and we were just tying some bead-headed flies, we'll call them. Mike comes up to us, given that Vladi is in between both of us, and say, oh, I see you're tying some Czech nips. Vladi is Polish and very proud Pola, and you could definitely tell he was ticked. You could see the veins popping out of his head, and eventually got to a point where he said, you want to see Czech nymphing? I'll give you Czech nymphing. Michael ran out of the room with his tail tucked between his tail. But the point is this. It really comes down to the Czech and the Poles are the same, and it's a very short line technique, a technique that was developed along maybe 20, 30 years ago. And most people actually say that the origin came from Poland. And I'll say that because I'm Polish. But fishing pocket water, places where a lot, you know, grayling for the most, a lot of times will like to hold in faster water, faster pocket water. Places where, you know, even shallow pocket water or just fast-moving rifts, places where a lot of anglers just pass over. These are areas where these fish will often like to hold in some situations. The technique was just designed where you could actually just make very short cast and basically allow the fly to settle and then be in control immediately, begin to lead the flies immediately. Maybe the drift is only 2 or 3 feet, but you're in constant tension from the time that the fly enters the water to the end of the drift. And with the grayling are very subtle takers. They have a soft mouth, and they're not very aggressive are often not very aggressive with a fly. So one of the things that the poles first ended up doing was fishing heavier flies, allowing the flies to settle on the bottom, and they would actually literally drag the flies slightly faster than the current. And what this would do is actually create tension, enough tension to the point where any time a subtle take of a grayling occurred, they would be able to register those takes. That was, if I have heard correctly from Velotti and all my mentors overseas, that was kind of the impetus of Czech nymphing / Polish nymphing, just the very beginnings. Now it's morphed into everything, basically. There are really no boundaries with Czech and Polish nymphing, but that was kind of the origin as it was explained to me. French nymphing is essentially the same thing where you're using a tight line technique. The problem is if you go to France or a lot of the streams that we fished, like in Spain or where I was in Portugal, you're talking about low, clear water. And with the short Czech line or Polish techniques where you're using a shorter leader and a shorter cast, you get close within fish or close within the fish's range. And a lot of these waters in France and throughout parts of Western Europe, you can't get that close. You need to shoot distance. So what they ended up doing was adapting that technique with a tight line technique, but essentially extending the leader to the point where sometimes the leaders extend to 25 or 30 feet, to the point where when they were casting, there was absolutely no line and leader on the water. Because even on some of these slower pools, if anyone can be a witness to, laying a 2 or a 3 weight line on this slow, delicate moving section of water would even a delicate presentation would spook fish. So what these guys ended up doing, the French and the Spanish in particular, was just extending the length of the leader. So essentially they were casting the weighted fly, but now allowing hardly any leader or line on the water, holding all line leader off the water just so you don't have any resistance other than the fly actually landed in the water. So those, in my opinion, those are the real two big distinctions between the Czechs and the French / Spanish style of nymphing.
Okay, very good description, I think. So and you've just described, we did have a couple questions on the type of water that's you would use these on, and I think you just described that rather well for both those techniques. Dale in Durham, North Carolina asked about could these techniques be used on low gradient spring creeks? He says shallow, low-gradient spring creeks, so I would take, maybe the French style might suit that more.
Absolutely. Something where you could actually hold just about all the line leader off the water, maybe crawling down your hands or knees, and basically just, with that type of system, think about it. If you have a 25-foot leader and you have a 10-foot rod, just about all the leader is outside the rod tip. The leader is 25-foot and the rod is 10-foot. You have essentially 30 feet. Of distance, given that there's some angles. So you're talking maybe 30 feet you could actually present a fly to a fish without having any line on the water. So even in the most extreme conditions, 30, 35 feet, you should be able to fish even the low, clear spring creeks where you are in North Carolina with that style of French nymphing. And then if you do need to shoot distance where you actually have to make a longer cast, that's where you go to a curlicue system or that system, but instead of using a longer leader, because you're going to have to make such a long cast, often, when I use a curlicue, I'm making casts beyond 45, 50 feet. You want to shorten up the leader. Sometimes I'm using a 7.5-foot OX leader, something that's shorter, stouter, that has the power. I tie on my curlicue, and then along with my section of tippet, that usually goes between 3 and 6 feet. But the key is with a curlicue, if you want to shoot distance, you have to have a shorter, stouter leader to make the cast. Trying to cast a wind-resistant curlicue on a 25 or a 30-foot leader is an absolute nightmare, and it's almost impossible, at least for mortals like myself, to do. So by all means, when you're tight-line nymphing, use that straight-sider. You can do that with a 25-foot leader, but as soon as you go to a curlicue and need to shoot distance, you need to shorten up the leader to allow you to create the power needed in the leader to turn over that curlicue.
Brian in Westby, Wisconsin asks, he says, at times I don't like to use a strike indicator so that I don't spook the fish on our small streams. I'm also concerned, though, of pulling the fly too quickly through a run, making the nymph look unnatural. Is this really not a big deal? Is there a good way to know how much tension to keep on your line? to feel any takes?
I love that question. That's a great question, Brian. It's all a matter about what the fish are doing and reacting. You know, I heard Gary Borger talk about the size of a trout's brain and actually the actual intelligence of a fish. Fish are not super smart. They have a brain the size of a pea, but what they do, they register natural movement. What they do is they react to natural movement. So when you're talking about insects, when you're nymph fishing, you need to think about what the fish are eating and how those insects are actually moving. So in the beginning of a hatch or during normal times where maybe the nymphs that you're imitating or just nymphs in general are not very active, in those situations, you want the fly to basically move the same speed as the current, because maybe they get knocked off a piece of vegetation. The bugs are not that active. They're just moving with the current, basically moving with the flow. So in those situations, you want the fly to move naturally. However, there are times, especially during hatches, even on small spring creeks where you have significant hatches, dragging your fly is going to be important, because those insects, as they're emerging from the stream bottom up to the surface, are actually swimming up. So they're not only moving against the current, but they're sometimes moving faster than the current. So when you're doing that, you actually need to do what the French call the induced take, meaning that what the French are particularly masters of, everyone has heard of like the Lysinger lift, where you make a cast upstream, make a couple mends, allow the fly to quickly settle to the bottom, let the fly drop, and then eventually as that fly line and rod tip position gets past you, you stop the rod tip, create the tension, and allow that fly to begin to go under tension, to begin to arise from the bottom all the way to the surface to imitate that emerging insect. The problem is with that technique, it's great for searching when you're fishing big water and you don't know where fish are, but the problem is with that technique, it takes a while, you know, for the cast, the mend, the fly line to sink, and for the tension to occur and for the arise to occur, for that to happen. So what the French end up doing, they call it the induced take, is that they'll often fish a long leader, fish a heavily weighted fly or a heavier weighted fly. They'll cast the fly into the water, let the fly anchor itself. And with that long leader, there's no line leader on the water. It's essentially a tight line, no pun intended, from the rod to the nymph. And what they'll actually do is just elevate that rod tip vertical and manipulate the movement of the fly. So it's not moving naturally. It's actually being induced or being moved towards the surface of the water, imitating that natural motion. The great thing with that technique is that you can do that whole process, the cast, the drift, all within 4 to 5 seconds. And within, you know, you do it in 5 seconds, you can get 20 of those drifts within a minute if you do the math. So it's a fast, rapid technique to allow you to move those flies faster through the current. So, again, going back to your point, and a great question, Brian, but you need to think about the insects that you're moving, or more importantly, the types of insects that the fish are feeding on at the time and how they're moving. Sometimes you want it moving natural. Sometimes you actually want them moving a little faster based on what's going on.
If when you approach a stream, you've got, when we're talking about dynamic nymphing, you've got all these techniques, tactics in your bag of tricks in your mind. What's your approach when you walk up to a river and, you know, you're looking out over it? Do you have kind of a breakdown of what determines what direction you're going to go with your nymphing?
Yeah, good question, Roger. Two things. I look at this. The main distinctions I look at between breaking it down from suspension nymphing to tight line techniques is I look at the drift. Basically, wherever I start planning on fishing, and I look at whether there is a significant drop in water depth, meaning that if I'm making a cast during my presentation, is where my fly landed on the bottom, is that depth changing greatly from where the fly lands to where the fly ends at the drift? Meaning like in pocket water. When you're fishing in pocket water where sometimes you're standing right on top of the pocket, you may cast into the top of the pocket where it may only be 6 or 7 inches in deep. But then all of a sudden, within about 3 or 4 foot of the actual flow of the current, it drops to maybe 4 or 5 foot. In those situations where there is a significant drop from shallow to deep, that is where I go into a tight line technique, because in tight line techniques, you can control the depth. So meaning that in shallower water, as soon as you make the cast, you can begin leading the flies. However, as soon as that fly begins going into that drop and that deep drop off, I'm actually going to stop moving the rod tip, allow my flies to actually gain the bottom, essentially throwing slack in that rig, allowing the flies to drop, and once they get on the bottom, then resume to move the rod tip downstream. The problem is trying to use a suspension tool in those situations is this, is that the line is at a fixed length from the flies to the indicator, and so the indicator suspends those flies at a fixed depth. So it's so much difficult to fish those areas where you have extreme change in depth with an indicator because the indicator fishes your fly only at one depth. So when I'm fishing areas where I know have a uniform current or more or less a uniform depth, where the depth is going to be the same as it is on top as it is on the bottom, you can go to a suspension tool because I know I'm going to be on the bottom all the time from the very top to the bottom. So hopefully I explain that any time that I know there's exceptionally different, great differences in depths in my presentation, I go to a tight line as compared to where I have uniform depth from the top of my cast to the back of my presentation. That's where I go to a suspension rig because I know that fixed point is still on an indicator is going to be able to fish that rig effectively from the top of the cast back to me.
So that's why I think somewhere in your book I read that you like to use suspension systems when you're fishing from drift boats or rafts. Probably talking long runs where the depth remains the same and you can just drift that right at that specific point above the bottom, right?
Exactly. And if you're in the area where you have really honed in, which I normally don't do, it usually takes me a while to catch on, but if you have honed in and zeroed in on exactly the exact depth that fish are feeding at, maybe they're stuck at a particular depth. Maybe you're fishing a lake or a large body of water in a river, the fish are at a fixed depth, you can set up your indicator so it fishes the fly at that fixed depth. Tight line techniques just allow you to fish more layers in the water column faster and more effectively, I believe, than does indicators because it just takes time to adjust indicators, the length.
You can do that all in one drift, too, right?
Correct.
The tight line, yeah. Running out of time here. I'm going longer because I know we had some delays getting going, but there were a few questions about competition fly fishing, and I wanted to kind of grab those two as best we can here because I know you're involved in that, and a lot of people obviously know you're involved in that or were involved in that. One question from Jerry in New York is, why are all the competitions in Europe? Why aren't we seeing more of them here?
You know, I think you're starting to see. That's a good question. Over in Europe, I don't understand. I don't know why there are more competitions over there. It's maybe something in the culture. Originally, a lot of the things, especially like when I went to Scotland a number of years ago, not all the competitions are high stress. It's a lot of ways. Every weekend, fishing clubs and organizations have competitions, just friendly competitions where guys will go out, fish a lot of the lochs in Scotland just as a way to maybe get some of their creative juices or get some of their competitive juices out of them, but more importantly, just go out and spend some time with friends. So in my opinion and in my experiences in Europe, a lot of the competitions are just excuses for guys to get together and fish. Of course, there's a far more concentrated effort in some of the other international scenes, like the World Championships, where there is definitely a distinct focus. But here in the States, we have competitions starting to pop up. If you go on to, like, troutlegend.com, there's a bunch of teams forming. Colorado has a new team, I guess. I think California is starting to talk about a new team. There's three or four teams in Pennsylvania that are starting. The North Carolina fly fishing team, Team Stonefly. There's Team Dead Drift down in Georgia. So there are a bunch of teams that are starting to pop up. And, again, it's just these guys are, maybe – some of them have ambitions of joining the U.S. team and going overseas, but a lot of the guys that I've been in contact and just spent some time with, they just have a great sensation of being able to go out and fish with friends. And more importantly, whether you like competitions or not, in some ways competitions I think are good because what it does, it forces your mind to begin thinking about the most effective or sometimes the most efficient ways of fly fishing. And as a result, a lot of these techniques that we talked about tonight, about the European nymphing methods, are just some of the refinements that anglers like, Sawyer and Skews in England originated. And guys like George Harvey and Humphreys and Joe Brooks and all these guys. These are just techniques through the years that they've refined a lot of those older school techniques into tools that allows them to deal with a wide range of techniques. So because of that, the competition, there's always things that are being pushed that are not revolutionary, but just small improvements, in my opinion, like the cider material being put into your fly or the use of tungsten using weighted flies as compared to split shot. Just small improvements that I think that really simplify your day, because most of us have real jobs and are busy and don't have as much time on the water as we like, so we like to find the most effective, most efficient way to fly fish. And a lot of the techniques that we're learning in the competition are being brought into the competition scene. The normal, leisure, everyday angler, including myself nowadays, can implement. This makes life easier, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's been some kind of aversion to, competition fly fishing in the U.S. and maybe because of the trying to separate themselves from the bass tournaments, But it's from what I've seen, totally different experience with fly fishing tournaments than it is with bass tournaments. Oh, George, did you want to say something?
No, I was just saying, yeah. I mean, there are, people talk about, these guys are the best anglers in the country. That's not the case. I was a former two-time national champion. And I can tell you right now, there are streams, for example, if I go up to the west branch of the Delaware River right now today, there are a number of guys that live in that water that would just kick my rear end on those waters. There are so many great anglers in the country and in the world that don't compete. And I can just name, we can name a lot of the people that have been on your shows. Competitive anglers is just, a lot of the guys I think just enjoy the competition. Some guys, including myself for the longest time, sometimes need a little pressure. You need to kind of see how far you can go. And for me, having the pressure upon competition, seeing what I could do, really forced me to see my limits, what I could and what I couldn't do. And because of that, I enjoy it. But anymore now, since I got older, you have a family. You have a lot more responsibilities. I look to competitive fly fishing as kind of, it takes the fun out of it now. When I competed before, I really had no, I had like a part-time job and really had no structure in my life. Now I have a job, I have a family, I'm trying to, put money into their retirement, trying to put money into their college funds. So when I go fishing, I want to relax. I want to get away from everything. So I can definitely understand that people don't want to compete, and I can appreciate that, because anymore, competition is the last thing on my mind. But in some ways, as I mentioned before, it's good. And the beautiful thing about this is we live in a free country. You don't have to compete. If you don't want to compete, you don't have to. And there's plenty of opportunities for people who want to go out and see how well they can do. They can go on to forums like Trout Legend and take a look and see what type of competitions are in their region.
Yeah, great. I think that's on that note. We'll call it quits for tonight. And wrap things up. But stick with us, folks. We're going to do our giveaways here. We're going to be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. And we'll also be giving away a copy of George's book, Dynamic Nymphing, which I know you'll all want to get a copy of after tonight's show, and excellent book. So stick with us here a few more minutes, and George, definitely stick with me, because I'm going to need your help determining who the winner is for your book. So we'll be right back. A mining company called Pac Rim Coal is planning a massive strip mine near Anchorage, Alaska. The Chuitna Coal Project would be the first project in Alaska history to mine directly through salmon habitat, the Chuitna River drainage, 11 miles of it. Critical commercial, sport, and subsistence fishing economies would be permanently destroyed. Pac Rim says it can rebuild a salmon stream, but scientific experts can find no example where successful restoration has occurred after strip mining. Chuitna Coal would be shipped to Asia, leaving Alaska with nothing but devastated habitat and ruined salmon runs. It's time to stop the Chuitna Coal strip mine. For more information on how you can help, go to www.inletkeeper.org, inletkeeper.org, or go to www.trustees.org, trustees.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You'll find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. So now it's time to give away a few prizes. And first thing we're going to do is give away that one-year membership to Federation of Fly Fishers is a great organization to support. Now, if you didn't already register on our website for the drawings, it's too late now, but make sure you do it next time so you have a chance on winning one of these great prizes. So our winner for Federation of Fly Fishers is going to be Jim Hopkins in South Carolina. Jim Hopkins. So congratulations, Jim. And for those of you that didn't win, check out the Fed's website, fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org, and you can learn about what they do. And then we have this one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. Learn more about them in case you don't win tonight. Go to flyfusionmag.com, flyfusionmag.com, a great magazine to learn from. And we have Jim Kilburn in Colorado. So congratulations, Jim, on that. And if either of you already have a membership or subscription, we'll get that extended for you. And enjoy. Now, we need to see who our winner will be for George's book. And the way we do this, George, is I come up with a question, and lately I've been doing two-part questions just to make it a little bit harder for folks. And this won't be too hard tonight if they were listening. When we were talking about putting beads on nymphs, there was a particular color bead. This is a two-part question, remember, so hold on for the second question. The first part is, what color bead did George say he liked to use under sunny conditions? What color bead? And secondly, what's his favorite suspension device? Favorite suspension device. So give me a correct answer to those. And I'm going to run these by you, George. First answer was pink beads, but he, whether that's right or wrong, he didn't put in the second answer. So we're going to skip over that one. And here he says brass or black and curly Q. Wasn't the brass or black on sunny days, was it, George?
No, it wasn't.
No. Okay, so we'll keep looking here. Fluorescent pink and curly Q.
No.
No, still not there. Silver bead and dry fly. Getting closer, but
getting close. I must have put your guys asleep. I'm sorry, Roger.
I don't think so. Oh, here we go. I think we got one. How about a silver bead and a thingamabobber?
That's the ticket right there.
Yeah, that's what I was looking for. So Megan in Lancaster. I'm assuming that's Pennsylvania, right?
Sounds like it.
Yeah, it might be in your neck of the woods over there. So Megan, you just won George's book. Congratulations. You're going to love this. Megan, you need to send me your address. Contact information. You can do that in the same text box that you just sent the answer, or you can send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com, info@askaboutflyfishing.com, and we'll get that sent out to you directly from Stackpole Books. So thanks for playing, Megan, and congratulations. I'm glad you won, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy the prize. Well, George, thanks so much for being on the show tonight. I really appreciate it, taking your time. I know we had a fantastic turnout tonight, and we had way more questions than we could get answers. Sorry for you folks that asked questions and didn't get them answered, but as you can see, we just George really put out tonight and gave us a lot of good information, and we just ran out of time. But thank you, George, for being on the show.
Oh, thank you, Roger, and thanks for everyone to listen. It was a great pleasure.
Well, great, thanks. Our next broadcast will be on February 15th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, we're going to interview Mikey Weir. And our topic for the show will be fly fishing the Truckee River. Mikey has been guiding in the Lake Tahoe area for over 15 years and calls the Truckee River his home water. Truckee River is a tailwater that flows from Lake Tahoe for 120 miles, ending at Pyramid Lake in Nevada. This river is technically a tailwater, but at times it flows like a freestone stream. And also fishes like a spring creek. So listen in to learn Mikey's secrets about fishing this challenging water. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Front Range Anglers, Harper Creek Fly Fishing Company, the Housatonic River Outfitters, for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.